This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. Vitris Conley is an author, playwright, podcaster, and now an entrepreneur here in downtown Chattanooga. A few months ago, she opened Unveiled Bridal Studio on Cherry Street, a business that unites her passions for fashion and supporting Black designers. Vitris, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Ray. Good to talk with you again.
Good to talk with you again. Tell us more about Unveiled.
Yes, so Unveiled Bridal Studio is actually located in the downtown Chattanooga area. We are at 707 Cherry Street. Super excited to be in the Innovation District downtown. And the studio was started, it was kind of like a pandemic baby for me. I was working on the business plan all throughout 2020 and was granted the opportunity to grab the studio in November of 2020. So our grand opening was actually January 15th of 2021. But Unveiled Bridal Studio is a very small, eclectic bridal studio that caters to bride sizes 0 to 32. So brides of all shapes, sizes, and cultures. And I wanted to bring something really different to the city that featured not only designers from across the United States, but most importantly, African American designers, wedding gown designers. I wanted to bring that to the Chattanooga area. So not only do I sell African American wedding designers, I also have a bridesmaid collection, and I do veils and I do bridal accessories as well. So just a very eclectic bridal studio. Want to be open and just different so that brides have somewhere to come that's just a little bit different, a little more unique, and just has that sizing for, like I said, brides from 0 to 32.
What inspired you to create this business?
Oh, goodness, so many things. First and foremost, my partner proposed to me in 2018. We had been together for years and years and years. And when he did that, that kind of catapulted us to start wedding planning. So my first business was to find a wedding gown. I had never been in a bridal studio. And I tell you, when I actually walked in for that first appointment, it was like, I felt like a queen. I felt like everything going on at that moment was just for me. The attendants were, you know, very catering to my needs. You know, I had my mom with me, my daughter, and some of my closest friends. We had champagne. I just knew the experience was something unmatched, and I had never had that experience in a boutique. I've always been into fashion. I've had my own clothing line since 2012, so I had always aspired to have my own brick-and-mortar boutique, but definitely after having that bridal experience as a bride, I knew that this is something that I wanted to bring to other brides, especially, you know, brides that look like me. I wanted to bring that experience to this area and just let them know that when they come to my studio, they're going to feel the exact same experience that I felt when I first walked in the bridal studio that I went to.
It's been tough to open brick and mortar, not only around here, even before the pandemic. And then you had the pandemic on top of that.
Yeah, I'm a little crazy, Ray. I get this question all the time. The hardest part was getting funding. And that's something that I'm very open to talk about with others that are inspiring to start businesses, and then specifically a brick and mortar business, is getting the funds to do that type of business. And especially my business, because it's considered a niche service. It's not something that everyone can partake in. So it was very tough, very difficult. And like you said, on top of that, we were in a pandemic. So a lot of current brick and mortar businesses were struggling. So they were looking for funding as well to keep their doors open. So I got a lot of no's in the beginning. A lot of, you know, you're just starting out. You're too new. You've never owned a business. You've never started a business. Kind of, you know, a lot of things more against me than for me doing it. But I didn't give up. You know, I really kept pushing. I kept perfecting my business plan. I reached out to a lot of mentors. I gained a wonderful relationship with a banker. So these are all things that when I'm talking to people about doing a startup, you really want to have, you know, an awesome business plan, awesome relationship with mentors, business mentors, and then a good relationship with a banker. So all three of those things combined, and just really the drive to not give up, to just know that I really had an awesome business that I really wanted to bring to the community. just all four of those things combined, I was able to do it. But it definitely, it was a struggle. Even 3 months into the business, I'm still pushing to stay funded. Bringing in revenue is not an easy thing as a startup. So there's just so much behind it. But, you know, if you're driven and you've got good people around you, and definitely those who have that professional business mind and who have had their own businesses, it's been very encouraging. But yes, starting out, it was a very difficult task to complete.
And tell us more about this niche. You wanted to have a business not only for, but especially for women who look like you, for African-American women. Tell us more about this business and this fashion when it comes to African-American women.
Yeah, so there's a lot, Ray, that I can go into, but I would say the two biggest things are the sizing. African-American women, and a lot of women in general, but more specifically women of color, we sometimes have difficulty finding clothing that fits our unique shapes. You have a lot of African-American women out there who are very curvy in their hip and their brassiere area. And so they have issues with certain cut dresses and how they fit. So that was a big thing for me, is wanting to provide those sizes for women that look like me that are very curvy. I don't really have that issue. I wasn't blessed like a lot of my sisters and my mother and their friends are, but I knew that going into that, I wanted to cater to that because I've had a lot of times with my sorority sisters and even some of my close friends that they've had that issue. So definitely being able to offer that 0 to 32 sizing for the more curvier bride. And the second thing was really encouraging Black women and women of color that they are celebrated in the bridal industry. I did a lot of research about this topic and just learning that some people have this stereotype that Black women don't get married, that we have children, we may stay with our partners long term, but we don't have weddings, we don't get married, and that's just not true. We deserve to have an amazing ceremony. We deserve to have, you know, amazing wedding. And most importantly, we deserve to have amazing bridal gowns. So I just knew that going into this, I wanted to be a spokesperson for women of color. And I just wanted to be the example to other bridal studios and other bridal boutiques out there that, you know, it's very beneficial to cater to women of color and just making sure that they do have the gown that will make them feel like the queen they are on their very special day.
You're also an author and a podcaster, or have you put those aside while you are launching this business?
No, sir, not at all. You know, I'm all about self-care. And with this business, I've had to take a lot of personal time to do self-care for myself. But no, I still have my podcast, X Times or More, the podcast. It's on all major streaming podcasts. Sites, you know, like your Google and your Spotify. But yeah, definitely still writing, working on a play right now. Those are the things that I do to stay sane, away from business, away from the day-to-day grind. Love connecting with other women who need advice on self-care and just how to be more grateful for life and living every day. So no, I will always love writing, always love podcasting. And most importantly, with this studio, I've just found another way to connect with women because I'm all about connecting with women of all shapes, sizes, and most importantly, cultures. We're all more alike than we are different. So that's very, very important to me.
If they want more information, where can they go online?
Yeah, so I would love for anyone listening that is looking to buy a bridal gown or if you're planning your wedding, follow me on Instagram and Facebook at Unveiled Bridal Studio. I have a website, www.unveiledbridalstudio.com. You can do all your booking from that site. You can also see all the wonderful designers that I carry on there as well. And I do appointment only. So why do I do appointment only? I want you to have the best personal experience, like I mentioned earlier in the interview. So the studio would be all for you in that timing. So if you're the mother of a bride getting married, it would be you and your daughter and whoever else she wants to invite to just have the whole studio to yourself. So I just very much encourage brides to book there. Would love to have you come in and have a private appointment. And then another thing is that I do consignment. So that's another niche that I offer. So if you're a bride that's already been married, that's looking to sell your dress or consign your dress, I would love to meet you as well. And that appointment is also available on the website. But love, love, love to connect. So just reach out to me on social media or through the website, and we can get you booked.
All right. Vitris, thanks so much.
Thank you, Ray. Have an awesome day.
Bluebird enthusiasts here in the Chattanooga area have a few opportunities to, yes, flock to this weekend and beyond. Don Hazel of Crossville is president of the Tennessee Bluebird Society, and Allison Hoffman of Signal Mountain is co-manager of the Society's Tri-State Chapter. Don, Allison, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Ray.
Thank you for having us.
Tell us more about this gathering of bluebird enthusiasts.
Late summer of 2018, I met Don at a Master Gardeners program in Crossville, Tennessee, and we have become friends, and he has been encouraging me through these years to try to help him set up a local chapter of the Tennessee Bluebird Society, which its purpose is to help cavity nesting birds have good homes and protected homes and to monitor how they're doing.
Yeah, the Tennessee Bluebird Society's goal is to help native cavity nesting birds, of which primarily they're bluebirds, tree swallows, Carolina chickadees, and they're birds that they need a home. And the reason they do is because back around 1900, humans introduced house sparrows and starlings to the United States. And those two birds are non-natives, and they're very aggressive. They take over every available hole in a tree that they can find. And because of that, they're now the most populous birds in the U.S. And bluebirds have a hard time finding a place to build a nest. And they always build a nest in a hole in a tree or a hole in an old fence post or a bluebird box that we now use to put in yards. And if they can't find a place to nest, they just don't nest. So bluebird populations plummeted by up to 90% between 1900 and 1980, mainly because of house sparrows and starlings, non-native birds that just took over every available nesting site. And humans about that time figured out how to build bluebird boxes, give them a place to nest. And now the population is back to where it was over 100 years ago, up to about 20 million in the east of the United States. So the boxes that are a place for them to live is critical. And that's what the Tennessee Bluebird Society, the North American Bluebird Society, and the Tri-State Chapters, that's what they do. They give them a place to nest so the bluebirds can thrive again.
And that's why you'll be hosting a bluebird nesting demonstration this weekend at Reflection Riding.
Yes, we will. Reflection Riding is having their annual City Nature Challenge 2021. On Friday and Saturday of this coming weekend, they are going to be doing a variety of things. And at 2 o'clock on Saturday, our group, the Tri-State Bluebird Chapter, will be there. And Don will be there with all of his props and so forth. And he will actually construct a bluebird house and the necessary predator guard that goes along with the bluebird house.
We're going to demonstrate what a proper house looks like. And a good bluebird house is not one that is really tightly made with a perch out front. That's not good for bluebirds. It attracts house sparrows. So a proper bluebird box is a certain size, inch and a half hole, ventilation for the babies. We'll demonstrate all that. And then also, many people buy a bluebird box and they put it on a tree in their backyard. And that's absolutely the worst place you can put a bluebird box, because on a tree, all the predators that attack bluebirds can reach them. Raccoons, rat snakes, mice, ants, they can all go right up the tree and get in the box and kill the babies, eat the eggs. So a proper box would be on a pole with a predator guard to protect against those predators.
Beyond this weekend, you are planning bluebird box trails and parks and golf courses around Chattanooga.
Yes. And on Saturday, we will have information about all this. We will also have our enrollment forms that people can sign up and join our group. And what our group is doing is building houses, building the whole system. And then we're going to install them in various places around the community where we will have teams of monitors go on a weekly basis, continuing through August when the bluebirds have finished fledging their last little nest of babies. And the first one of these is planned for White Oak Park in Red Bank. And the second one is planned for Reflection Writing. And the second one actually is going to be installed. It will be the first one, I guess, that's going to be installed, because it's going to be installed on Sunday, May the 1st at 2 o'clock at Reflection Writing.
And if people want more information on all of this, where can they go online?
They can look at our Facebook page at Tri-State Bluebird Chapter of the Tennessee Bluebird Society. The Facebook page contains a link to our application. We will also have, well, it's a membership form. We will also have those available at our booth at Reflection Writing on Saturday at 2 o'clock.
All right. Allison, Don, thanks so much.
Thank you, Ray.
Thank you.
You're listening to Scenic Roots. More in a moment.
This is Scenic Roots talking writing. This is the second half of my conversation with poet and teacher KB Ballantyne. KB teaches creative writing, theater arts, and literature at Ray County High School. She's also an adjunct professor at Chattanooga State Community College. Her most recent collection, just published, titled Edge of the Echo, is broken into four sections, each named for one of the elements: fire, water, air, and earth. Why did you divide the collection into air, earth, fire, and water?
The four elements. It was the idea behind the ancient Celtic idea of those being the basis of life. Those are the things that give us life. And, you know, air is our breath, and water is our depth, and fire is our heart and our passion, and the earth is our memory. You know, it was here before we were, and we become part of it. And so all of those ideas are in Celtic literature and poetry. And I think once I had read the John O'Donohue book, I realized that's, and I went back and read all my poems that were mainly Celtic geared. I thought, oh, yes, I see. You know, I see these images coming back over and over.
But then, interestingly, when it comes to water, you begin talking about the immigrant experience, or the emigrant experience, actually.
Right. Well, you know, that's what brought us here, brought my people here.
So when you are in Ireland or in Scotland, and you, as you said, have that sense of being home, it's because of that, that's your ancestry.
I think so. I think that, I mean, I like being in England, but I don't feel at home there. And when I've gone to the cities in Ireland and Scotland, I don't really feel at home, because they feel like every other city I've ever been in. But when I go out into the country, and specifically the coastline, I mean, and I was born in Florida, and so I guess all of that water speaks to me more significantly than perhaps the other three do.
I think it must be very strange to grow up in a place that's land-bound. I can't imagine that, although I've lived in a place that's land-bound for a long time. But I grew up on an island. I'm not sure how that informs how we think and how we feel about things, but I think it must do. So was that conscious on your part? Were you looking to reconnect with your Celtic ancestry?
No, I don't. I said no, but maybe. You know, my first book, Gathering Stones, was written because I was specifically looking. I belonged to a poetry group in town called Rhyme and Chat, and a lot of the members there were writing these wonderful poems about their ancestry, and I thought, I don't have an ancestry. You know, this is back when I was young and didn't realize a lot of things. I thought, I don't have an ancestry. And then I started doing some family research, and my grandmother had done some family research. And when I started looking into it and discovered the Irish and the Scottish, the Irish is my mother's side and the Scottish is my father's side, it just sort of came into being. And I specifically went looking for it for that first book. And that first book was written because of the people at Rhyme and Chat and the fact that they had been talking about their ancestry. But now I don't think I write consciously about it anymore. I think I just write, and sometimes that comes out. Sometimes when I've visited over there, it comes out more. You know, some places speak to me very deeply, and so I end up writing about them, and you see, you know, little epigraphs, I guess, underneath the poem titles about this place. This is where this poem was conceived.
Like a baby.
Right.
How many generations have your family been in this country?
I don't know exactly. We can only go back so far. My mom's side, because we get to a Smith and a Ryan.
Oh,
and
yeah, I'm with you.
There's right. Nowhere to go from right. A Smith and a Ryan.
Right.
But my father's people, we were the Balls on the Tyne River. And so that's where Ballantyne came from, because it was Ball on Tyne and then Ballantyne.
Oh, okay.
And then, you know, both my mom's ancestors and my dad's ancestors changed the spelling of the last name. And I first went to Ireland looking for O'Harens, because everybody had said that since my mom's last name was Heron, then it was probably O'Haron. So I went looking for O'Haron. And everybody in Ireland, the kind ones, just said, no, there's no such thing. And the not so kind ones laughed at me. There's no such thing as an O'Haron. And I thought, I know my people came from here. And then I finally discovered that the people who let us into this country had just spelled O'Haron, and it was Ahern with an A.
Right. Right.
And I thought, oh. And it was a very kind lady at Kenny's Bookshop in Galway who said, let's talk about this. And it, you know, when after we talked and we explained, and I had seen my grandfather's family coat of arms on his wall, you know, the not like we're royalty or wealthy or titled or anything, but the last name, somebody had printed off O'Haron, but had printed off the correct picture of three herons on a flag. And when I was telling her about that, she said, oh, and that's how we discovered the O'Haron connection. And I thought, wow, I'm so glad that there was an artist, that there was a visual representation instead of just somebody deciding to spell it however it sounded to them.
Oh, ain't it the truth? You can only imagine what a cattle call that must have been on Ellis Island, you know? I can't imagine. I've also learned fairly recently, you know, that people all the time would say Scots-Irish, and I assumed they meant Celtic and that they were either from Scotland or Ireland, but what they meant was Scottish people who were taken to Ireland. Is that right? It's that way, isn't it?
Yes.
And it was something to do with the Brits and the
right. It
the
was
Brits
transplanting. Yeah, it was transplanting
to increase the
British
Protestant
people.
Population.
Right, the British people, because the Scots were considered British into Ireland. So to balance out the Catholic Protestant, and also to give more voice for, you know, their government representation.
Right. And a lot of the people that moved to Appalachia were the Scots-Irish people, weren't they?
Right.
That's where that culture comes from. And then that same songwriter I was telling you about he said, well, you know what they call us hillbillies, you know? And so I had no idea, and I Googled it, and there aren't any historians that will support that theory, that hillbillies were Hill Scots who supported William of Orange, and that's why they called them hillbillies.
Oh.
So if your dad lived on the Tyne, then he must have been near the border then, huh? His family.
It was actually down in the southwestern part.
Right in the corner.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'd love for you to read some of your work, and, you know, frankly, I'd rather you choose than me.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because I'd just be interested to hear what you choose. Would you care to read one from each section?
Sure. So now I have to figure out which section they're all in. I did mark some that I thought you might like.
Well, I like so many of your poems. So it's not I want this one because in some ways, and it's probably because I don't know how to read poetry properly, but they all become of a piece. It's hard for me to think of them as individual poems. Mm-hmm. They're more like individual verses in a long story, you know?
Oh, that's nice. I like the way that you're thinking about that. this one is called Words Circling, and it's from the air section. To make my poems surge and sing, I would kidnap the color and chorus of birds. I'd seize the bright flash of bluebird that combines sky, hydrangeas, summer sea, and mix it with the wren's sun-bronzed song. I would catch the language of sorrow and love that weave through each line of a thrush's melody, the harmony of the finch burnishing stanza's timbre. Hijack nuthatch and meadowlark to pry deep into the verse of trees, flies and gnats snatched midair. Let passion blaze like a cardinal's fire in winter nests when couplets, tercets collide. The shimmery pulse of hummingbirds capture cadence, sweetness and luster so small, discovered only by tender readers. Circling above, blackbird inks words with a silent turn of curved head, listening to the rhythm, the shade, the echo of tears. Mm. All right, from the fire section, Awake a Fire. The fire burning earth's heart howls, sizzles through veins of clay and dirt, roaming with flickering fingers the belly of this world. Tongues of sulfur herded into geysers deny the sky its stars, while lightning sears ephemeral darkness. Hearths smored until morning, ashes wrap the bright berry of flame, spared another night to crowd this home with warmth and light. Sealed beneath our feet, it dances, the earth throbs and shivers. There's a place in Dingle, which is in County Kerry, Ireland, which is called An Fianacht, and I wrote this there. Leaving you in An Fianacht. Waves crest, staccato the rocky shore, then foam into nothingness. Late summer rakes the timothy, ridge shadowing horizon's edge. Clouds scribble a hydrangea blue sky, sweep salty tang to the cows, the vetch. Bruised with heat, forget-me-nots droop, but one pink bud dares the sun, and I bend to its sweetness. At the heart, a ladybug kisses my lips, ocean whispering its secrets.
Wow, what a great idea. What's a vetch?
It's the grass.
Oh, is it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And Dingle, it seems to me, it looks a lot like Cornwall. It's big rugged cliffs.
Only colder. Yeah.
And wilder. Yeah, so it's not protected like Cornwall, I guess. The Gulf Stream is what makes Cornwall so warm. We arrived in Dublin. It's about 9 o'clock at night. We came out of the airport, the rain, get on this bus, and the guy's, you know, cursing the weather and all this. Oh, welcome to Ireland, you know?
That's so funny because I just, you know, I guess in other places I do that. I think, oh, how inconvenient that I don't get to do what I want. But for some reason, in England, Ireland, and Scotland, I'm just, this is what it's going to be. Of course it's like this, you know. I'm passing out with heat stroke in Greece saying, why is it so hot here? Well, you know, because it's Greece and it's July.
I find myself reverting to childhood. Oh, my God, it's going to rain again, you know. But, you know, it doesn't.
I love it. I love it.
Yeah, well, I guess you just have to accept that, but it gets old. I can understand, especially the kids, why they don't like it, but.
Well, and again, I don't live there.
Yeah, exactly.
So if it happened every day, I might be saying the same thing, too.
Oh, I don't know. It's just, you know, on the other hand, oh, my God, it's so green.
I know. It's beautiful. Oh, I've never seen any place greener.
No. It's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Would you care to read one more?
Certainly. Your pick.
Okay. No, I know what I wanted you to read, because I love them. There's that whole series of, they look to me like haiku, 13 skeins of Irish knowing.
Ah.
So beautifully written. And is Wallace Stevens the one who wrote about the red wheelbarrow?
No, that's William Collar. Carlos Williams.
Yeah.
Well, Wallace Stevens wrote a piece called 13 Ways of Looking at a Blackbird. And so this is based off that. So I tried to do some of the same things he did in his poem.
And he was the insurance salesman, right?
Yes.
Oh, yes, that's always struck me as so weird.
Know, you know? Like Ted Kooser working in business, you know, working in accounting. And I just think I totally appreciate people who have a double brain. I have a friend who's an accountant, and it's just, I feel like they're more well-rounded. You know, they've got that business brain, and so they can look at they can look at language things differently. And myself, I'm just completely immersed in language, and so I don't know that I see it any differently. And I just really appreciate people who are doctors or accountants or insurance salesmen or whatever, and scientists. And I think, wow, you're bringing a whole new perspective to language. You know, you're opening up language that and using language that I wouldn't use because it's not in my vocabulary. So, I like that.
My experience with those with guys who, and it's a lot of them are men who think like that, they had a really hard time with the writing. They didn't like writing, and they didn't, you know, that part of their brain is not very developed. And then I think, you know, somebody like an accountant has got this ability to read numbers the way we read letters, you know?
Right. Yeah.
And that somebody who's got that capacity could also write poetry. That's really interesting.
I know.
I take your point.
I love that.
That's a really balanced person.
I think so. And and I don't know whether it's because they're just equally good at both, or in some cases, like before our modern century, I guess, maybe they had to go into it to make a living. And so their first calling would have been to be the writer. But, you know, you have to put food on the table. And so what do? You know, you choose something you can do. So, but then that opens up that field of language. It's not accessible to me. It's just that I'm not immersed in that. And I don't go out of my way to look up a scientific word or a business word.
Whenever I had to do something simply to make money, it drained so much energy. I didn't have a lot of time to do what I really wanted to do.
Right.
It didn't stop me doing it, I have to say. You know, I still kept chasing this, even though my mother thought I was crazy. But
and here you are.
Yeah, but you can see how that would happen to people, you know.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, you have a family, and it's exactly as you say. If you have a Tim Cofield, he's a videographer and musician, and he and his wife just had a baby. The pictures of them on the web, you know, the little ones looking up at him, and I'm like, oh my God, your life will never be the same.
Right.
You know, this other one's got like, you're her whole world.
Yes.
You know, and you are totally responsible for that little being now, you know, and you got to take care of her. So, you know, then somebody says, well, are you going to make another film, Tim? Well, I don't know, you know, I need the money. And, you know, you can see how that happens, you know.
Right. And then you're pulled away from your first love.
Yeah.
Yeah.
By another love, of course, you know.
Right, that's true too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Maybe not just one love. So in 13 Ways of Looking at a Blackbird, Wallace Stevens has a blackbird in each thing, in each section, or a reference to it. And so I tried to do that with this 13 Skeins of Irish Knowing, having something about a skein of wool, a thread, something about that that connects us. One, in emerald fields, braided haystacks, men stagger in the wind. Two, a woman and wool thread knit a home. A woman and wool thread and blanket stitches weave memories. Three, like three chains, the Trinity braids my life, eternal knot. Four, fragments of tweed and old suits patched into diamonds, green grown brown bodes hunger, braided knots and flower sacks empty. 5. Black leaves curl in September mist, tragedy weaving roots. 6. Fog spins low, thick, frost braiding thatch, lake. Ice moon halos the night. Curled in quilts, children witness shadows swelling, their own hollow eyes and bellies fill with winter white. 7. O lonely women of Kilkeeran, where are all your children? Do you not see how the gray in your braids, your swollen bellies, blistered tongues, sent them searching the blood-dark sea? 8. I know the hush of midnight, the song thrush greeting dawn. I know, too, the skein that weaves families, though acres of waves churn between them. 9. She suffered the Atlantic, her mam's quilt bearing what was left of her dreams. 10. At the city's shore, she pinned up her braids and left the boat. Dust and ash slipped like a chain around her neck, erasing the last traces of heather and tide. 11. In Kentucky, a second cousin faded into the mines, the gloom too much like strangling, rotting blossoms. Another voyage. This time iron rails needled the countryside. Ohio sparked into view, fabric of the river pricked by stars. 12. The dress she wore on the journey, now cut for the baby, the quilt. 13. It misted all night, dawn a moonstone over braided twigs. Soon the sun would shine, prisms stitched beneath a gold and smoldering ring.
The ones about the girl that really get me. She suffered the Atlantic. That's such a... But they're like haiku. About 14 words, the dress she wore on the journey, now cut for the baby, the quilt. I mean, there's a whole life in those two lines.
Right. This is the story of my people in encapsulated in sound bites.
But they're not sound bites. You know, in as much as a soundbite is just like a sort of superficial distillation, this is a very condensed distillation. It's just the opposite. It's like a bud that contains a flower.
Oh, that's nice. I like that a lot better.
You know.
Yeah.
So how do you write like that? How do you begin to write pieces like that? Do you write them as a longhand piece that you distill? Or?
This piece took a long time. I knew I wanted to do something after the 13 ways of looking at a blackbird. And I'm grateful to the poets who have gone before that we can imitate their forms and look at what they've done. I don't have to recreate anything. I can see something that's been done that I think works. And because I like that particular poem of Stevens, and I had a lot of Irish pieces about the history of the Irish people coming over, and so much of it sounds prosy, and so much of it is just too heartbreaking to tell the entire story of things. But when you can work pieces of it in and just give... Well, no, I wouldn't necessarily say they're highlights, but they're
more like prompts. Iron rails needled countryside. That's such a nice way to express that, because it's true. That's exactly what it does look like. They're sort of throwing these tendrils all over the
right. And then, of course, I was trying to get the imagery of the thread in there too.
Oh, right. Mm-hmm. And just, you know, it's hard to imagine what this country must have been like when those people first saw it. Where you came from, Florida, must have been a paradise, I would think.
I don't know. Probably depends on where you landed in Florida. If you were in the Everglades, maybe not so much.
It's sticky and mosquito-y.
Right. Especially if you're from Ireland or Scotland.
Oh, it's hot. That's true. Yeah, that's true. There's still plenty of places in Florida, to my eye, you know, where you can still see that. Mm-hmm. St. Augustine, a little bit, you know.
That's my favorite Florida city. You still have that flavor, even though there's part of it that's commercialized. You can still go out, you know, just 15 minutes away from the city, and you can find places that are seemingly isolated. We were talking earlier about feeling bad for the students, you know, who are leaving high school last year and didn't get to participate in some things. And, you know, I was reading something just last week, and one of the comments was the people leaving school in the 1940s because they were going to war. Mm-hmm. How many people? And so their senior year, their high school years weren't what they expected. My mom has told me stories about people she knew in school who went to Vietnam,
yeah.
And, you know, and didn't come back. And so her school year, you know, so I think there are lots of things. I mean, certainly COVID is something different than war, but the disruption of it is what people remember. And while we have periods of everything's the same, we always do this, there are occasionally those things that happen. And I think that's one of the things I want to write about in my poetry, is that these are the things that stay, you know, earth, wind, water, fire. These things stay. They'll always be with us. These are the things you can count on. And if you live in the moment, you live right now and pay attention to right now, you will enjoy that moment. But if you worry about things in the past, or you think, well, what am I going to get in the future? Then you've lost out on this present enjoyment that you could have.
Today is the tomorrow we worried about yesterday. And exactly what did you gain by worrying about it when you didn't even know what was going to happen? And that seems to me, that's what Seneca is saying too.
Right.
You know, that which you think is life is the wind and the rain and the thunder in the sky. That you may not like it, but hey, that's life, you know.
Right.
That in fact, our experience of life, Seneca would say that he actually pitied people who had never experienced misfortune. You've passed through life without an opponent. No one can ever know what you're capable of, not even you.
Oh, wow.
You know, that it's what you're saying, you know, that it's the adversity that shapes us. Not the comforts.
Right. And what are we going to do with this now that we've experienced it? Are we going to, you know, tuck our tails, tuck our head and cower in a corner? Or are we going to emerge, you know, more like a butterfly? We've come out of that cocoon and let's do something new and beautiful now.
KB Ballantyne's most recent collection, just published, is titled Edge of the Echo. On listener-supported public radio, this is Scenic Roots, talking writing.
I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Roots. We come to you from WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Email us at scenicroots423@gmail.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at scenicroots423. Listen to us online anytime at WUTC.org and the WUTC app. For Richard Winham and the rest of our team, join us again next time for Scenic Roots.